Sierra Dahl with Municipal Sustainable Energy Forum, and today our conversation is talking about the most effective process for motivating the public to action on renewable energy. Our presenters are Lynn Arthur with Peak Power in Long Island, Mark Scully for People to Action for Clean Energy over in Connecticut, and John Motlock Consulting, formerly from Ball State University in Indiana. So, Lynn, why don't you start us out here? Talk a little bit about what you're doing. Maybe, you know, 5 minutes for you and a couple minutes for everybody else so you can have conversations after that.
Okay, can you hear me all right?
We're all good,
yes.
Yep.
Okay, so, hi everyone, thanks for joining. It's a beautiful day here in the neighborhood, at least on the East Coast. So I formed a 501c3 because the municipality that I work with, which is the town of Southampton and then others, prefer to do business with a not-for-profit. I spend all of my time designing programs in conjunction with the municipality to educate their constituents as to the technology, the technical and the economic benefits of investing. Is that okay? Of investing in renewable energy. Most of the programs that I've worked on involve programs that were designed, you know, available from the state of New York through NYSERDA, New York State Energy Research and Development Authority. They're an awesome organization. They design the programs that help municipalities, small businesses, and residents make investments that align with the state goals. Problem is that everybody, as you know, is time starved and they won't take the time, nor will they get in their car and drive somewhere, I mean, even pre-COVID, to listen to a presentation, become educated on these things. So the challenge is simple. It's how to, you know, give them enough, or as we like to say, pitch it where they can hit it. You know, give them enough information so that they can take the right actions and get those benefits and do it in a really fast and now with COVID in a digital primarily method. I like working with municipalities simply because they're a trusted, you know, when you're working with government, it tends to be a trusted source. So that's kind of it in a nutshell. Sierra, did you want me to say anything more?
No, that's all right. John, why don't you go ahead and contribute to the conversation here?
Sure. Like Sierra said, I was at Ball State University. I still do sustainability teaching online for Ball State. I also consult in the area of sustainability. I work with an LLC also called Sustainable Communities that does community visioning with after a model of they developed at Ball State, operated about 20 years on basically going into community, spending intense 3 or 4 days in the community, visioning with people in the community, and generating some really pizzazzy kind of graphics that allow them to go out and use those to get funding and stuff. So we basically work with communities trying to help them shift to the next level, and we tend to work in energy, water, and food, and specifically in communities that have shown some initial steps in making building self-sufficiency in one of those, and then helping translate that into sufficiency in the others.
John, you worked a lot with SHRETS, didn't you?
Yeah, in fact, the program at Ball State really was earliest and SHRED program in the States. In fact, when the SHRED Institute started, my colleague at Ball State, Scott Truex, gave them many of the things that had been developed at Ball State. So Ball State's been doing charrettes for about 30 years. There was a time when they actually had a Winnebago that would go they'd bring into the community to do the charrettes. But for the last 20 years, it's basically been going into the community in some major venue, spending a one day basically going into various groups throughout the community, getting input, ideas, and then spending a second day in charrette in the community with people.
John, I'm going to interrupt you for a second. I want everybody to know I'm going to mute everybody, and then if you want to talk to a four and a star to unmute your own line, because we're getting a lot of background noise. So, and I'll unmute you, John.
Okay, so it's as I was saying, we go in intense work in the community for 3 days. If we do that through Ball State, which we do, we still do it with intense work with the students in academic programs in the community. If we do it through consulting, we have the three leaders of that those former Ball State who go into the community and do it as a consultancy. But it's all based on community charrettes.
How do you get them engaged in a community charrette, John?
There's usually a task force that the director of the institute, Scott Truex, usually has some initial meetings with the task force, and then we come in and do an intense charrette with the task force, usually 15, 20 people. And then based on that going to the next level, then we take it to the broader community.
Seems like I remember your students were involved in that in some way.
Yeah, in when we do it through Ball State, basically there's the students in the architecture, landscape architecture planning program all have the option to do these charrettes as a 4-credit extra, and so they sign up, and they all have taken a charrette graphics kind of a course, so they are fairly good at communicating graphically. And then the group of usually about 15 students will go into the community, arrive noon one day, one Friday afternoon. We'll go from venue to venue in the community, listening to people. And then on Saturday morning, all day Saturday, and this will have been well advertised in the community, all day Saturday, individuals will come in, and then groups will come in, like we usually have the children come in and for a session. But different groups will come in. They each do survey. They put little colored dots on boards as to if people were coming to visiting. To visit them, where would they take them? Where would they not want to take them? And so they have, and they get interviewed by students as they come in. And then that second day, students just work at their table, and with the notion that when someone from the community comes by, break what you're doing, explain to them what you're thinking, and really elicit information from them, feedback from them. Their ideas, this is what we think we heard yesterday, is that really what we should have heard, and this is what we think begins to address that, how does this seem to you? So we spend that whole day Saturday going one-on-one with people from the community in various interview formats, posting formats, whatever, and then at 5 o'clock on Saturday, the doors shut, and we have an intense student workshop synthesizing everything we've done and producing the product for those first 2 days. And then Sunday is usually Sunday morning is feed out our reporting back to the community our the latest developed ideas based on their input, and then they respond to that, give us further insight, and then that prepares the students. Then Sunday evening they go back to Ball State, and then they spend the rest of the semester working on the project, and then usually there's some kind of a closure event as well where then they take back what they've evolved, and of course the conversation keeps going by telephone and stuff in the interim, and then there's a major report out at the end. There's usually a report, so they have this nice graphic communication with really nice art in it that allows them not only to go seek funding with a story, but also with that story elaborated, enriched with the graphics that give images of what they're talking about doing.
All right. Mark, I wanted you to talk a little bit about the process that you've used over in Connecticut.
Great. Can you hear me now?
We're all good, yeah.
Okay, good. Yeah, so my name is Mark Scully. I'm with People's Action for Clean Energy, or PACE, in Connecticut. We're about a 45-year-old nonprofit, all-volunteer, that over the years has had really different activities, but all around promoting clean, renewable energy. And our focus over the last few years has been working with communities, and I can see why Sierra in her wisdom has brought the three of us together here, because I think there's a huge overlap and I think probably a common belief, certainly fundamental to our work, that so much happens at the local level. Of course, we need national policies, we need initiatives, we need incentives, we need state action, and we need individual action, of course, but there's just so much that can be done best and really can only be done at the town level. And so our work is with towns. It's typically with clean energy advocates, occasionally with town staff. Typically there's like a clean energy task force or a sustainability team, and those are the groups that we work with. And we find that these groups, they are typically volunteer. They sometimes it's a good collaboration with town staff, but everybody has limited resources. I know the people on these calls, when I listen in, have a pretty high level understanding of energy issues, but that's not always the case when you get out into the hamlets and people volunteering, wanting to do the right thing, wanting to help, but not really knowing how or having the tools. So our work is really dedicated to supporting these local groups. And the other, I think, fundamental belief that grounds what we do is we have to see the change. We have to. I think it's wonderful and powerful that so many towns and cities and states have passed resolutions to get to 100% or to cut carbon by percentages by certain dates. But when it gets to actually putting that into action, we need to see those steps that we need to take and the initiatives and in quite tangible terms. So PACE has worked, and it's a work in progress, but we have this sort of suite of tools that we work with towns on. And I'll just list three very, very high level. And the first is a fairly simple energy analysis of a town. And that's the first thing we do when a town, when we reach out to a town or a town reaches out to us. We get their aggregate energy usage from the electric utility, from the gas utility. We go in and get a grand list, a tax list of buildings and vehicles. So, and we put it into our model, which we're happy to share with anybody who would like it, and we make a lot of assumptions about miles driven by certain types of vehicles and miles per gallon and how much energy is used for heating buildings of various sizes, and it's an evolving model, but we get to an estimate of the total energy consumed by the town, and that's the municipality itself, that's the residents, and that's the businesses all together. And what's interesting is typically, to a town, that's a piece of information they've never seen. You know, the town itself, the municipality, tracks their own usage, and there may be some other statistics flying around, but nobody's ever looked at how much are we as a town, how much energy are we using, and how much are we spending on that energy. So that's a that's a really helpful sort of starting point, and it breaks it out to the different sources, transportation, heating and cooling, and electricity. And then we make a bunch of assumptions about what would that look like in a 100% renewable world where we've electrified everything and we're dispatching or we're procuring and we're building as much renewables as we can within the town's borders, but then outside it can involve a solar siting analysis where we'll look at how much rooftop solar we think the town could support or what other properties could be suitable. And then we, in that energy analysis, so we kind of show how much energy we're using now, how much that could be, and then what do the economics look like if we actually did that. We typically show that we'd actually end up spending a lot less and keeping more of the money within the town. So the energy analysis is the first tool that we work with towns. The second is then our website has what we call an online guidebook. So if a town wants to get started, they want to promote residential efficiency. Well, there are programs, there are case studies, there are resources there. If they want to promote solar in town or heat pumps, or microgrids, all kinds of things. There's case studies, there's PowerPoints, there's sample contracts. And one of the most useful tools that towns have found there is we have sort of an off-the-shelf energy plan. It has 100% renewable as its goal, and it addresses the various categories of renewables, of heating and cooling, of transportation. And that several towns have taken this now and customized it with relatively little effort. I mean, any energy plan takes effort, but we've seen towns struggle years to try to get one done, and now with this template, we've seen towns be able to get that done quickly, and that's a powerful tool for a town to then take around and have discussions with their various stakeholders. So that online guidebook is our second tool, and the last one, which is a work in progress, is an action plan for a town, so that you've done your benchmark energy analysis. You've got a bunch of resources of things you might want to do. Well, here's a plan, and it's basically a scorecard. So under the different categories, you've got a list of actions, you've got resources, you've got guidelines on how to do it, and you've got a point value. So towns can sort of score themselves on how are we doing, what progress are we making. So our goal, again, really using these three tools, is that typically volunteers in towns don't have to reinvent the wheel. They can they can get some of the support they need, get the resources, and actually take action. So, and the last thing we do is we have regular meetings of these advocates called the Connecticut Energy Network, and we have regular gatherings, and we exchange ideas and best practices, so kind of try to egg each other on. So That's a high level discussion of what PACE does.
All right. So I'm open for comments here. We can open this up for comments. Lynn, do you want to talk a little more about your process first? So we had an overview, but we really need to know more about specifics of how you achieved what you did. Do a 4 and a star to unmute your phone. There we go. No, not yet. Here, I'll unmute it for you. Never mind. There you go.
Cool. I got the message. Well, first of all, I am, like, overwhelmed and impressed with whom my colleagues on this panel have accomplished. I have a bunch of questions for the both of you, but I will hold them for now. So very similar to the last speaker, in New York, NYSERDA has a terrific website, so a lot of the structure and the programming has already been defined for us. So, for example, there are these 10 high-impact items, you know, to achieve the state's objectives, you know, which are 100% renewable for electricity by 2040, and then there's other things for storage and offshore wind and blah, blah, blah. But one of the things that I noticed early on was the benchmarking. You know, this business that you, the last speaker spoke about with regards to, you know, establishing a baseline. So that's the first order of effort, if you will, that we undertook. And again, not to be answered right now, but one of the challenges, you absolutely must establish a baseline, because how are you going to determine whether you're progressing against those goals? But it's no insignificant act to get that data. Getting the data from the utility has been, well, let me just say in a word, it's been a challenge. You know, we've had to issue things like freedom of information requests. My utilities, maybe I'm a bit unique. We don't have investor-owned utilities here. We don't have a competitive market. We have a vertically integrated state-owned monopoly. And they're self-regulating. So it could be that what I'm representing here is not necessarily the pervasive issue across the country, but that's a real critical element. If there's a state program that exists, the recommendation I would have is that you adopt it and that be one of your highest priorities. But if not, it sounds like this PACE program, which I'm going to go online right after this call and look at that website, because it sounds like it has all the programming that one would need in order to, you know, get that on its feet. But the bottom line is, in our case, that's what we did first. Then we looked at what other programs NYSERDA had to offer. And what I noticed as a volunteer member of the Town Sustainability Committee is that the town, you know, municipalities don't invest in the kind of skills that are needed in order to be successful at outreach. And what I'm talking about is, you know, communication skills, you know, strategic thinking as it relates to energy, you know. So, for example, we saw that there were multiple programs, but they're all run as individual silos. But there's no reason why they need to do that. So what I saw was an opportunity to just do something that I thought was pretty obvious, which was to, you know, take the home energy efficiency audit, that's a free service that's provided by the utility, combine that with a solar program that the state was running, and now the state is also encouraging battery storage to be adopted. And what I did was to just put these all together and create as simple a message, like I said before, to explain to the public what are these things, you know, what would they cost a homeowner, what kind of economic benefits would that homeowner achieve if they made that investment, like in a air source heat pump or a smart thermostat or a variable speed pool pump, or, you know, like for solar, we created a one-page summary of, you know, what is a typical system, you know, if your bill is, well, again, on Long Island, our electricity is amongst the highest in the country, by the way, but if you consume around 10,000 kilowatts per year, you know, what would a solar array look like? What would it cost to put on your roof to cover 100% of your bill? After all the subsidies, you know, what would that cost? What are the options for financing it? And comparing the finance, which, by the way, the rates right now are so low that anyone on Long Island who has a bill of about $200 a month, you can literally put a 10 kW system on your roof, finance it over 15 years, and that cost plus the net metering cost that you pay the utility is less than what you're paying right now for electricity. So when you show people, you know, again, I use lots of colorful pictures, but when you show people that they can do this, you know, that it's literally going to lower their operating costs, and, you know, as long as they have the right credit and, you know, they have a roof in this case that's, you know, mostly free from shade, you know, these investments pay off, and they pay off fast. And so it's really a matter of, in my case, creating marketing materials and then condensing it into as short of a message as possible. And pre-COVID, I would, when I would do a presentation, and oh, by the way, and it's also about, I go to where they're meeting. You know, we ran a couple of seminars at libraries, and literally nobody showed up. But when I would go to, like, the Kiwanis dinner or the, you know, Lions Club or the PTA or, you know, any of these groups, and I would talk for 20 minutes, again, with lots of, you know, diagrams and a sign-up sheet at the end of the presentation, I would literally get between, you know, if it was a brand-new audience that had never seen me speak before, usually somewhere between 60 and 100% of the audience would sign up for something. And by the way, what I mean by signing up is I would give them a one-page a form that they would sign up for a free audit or a free evaluation. You know, it's basically I would generate leads then for others to follow up and talk to that potential customer about, you know, whatever the item is that they signed up for. And then back to benchmarking, you know, then you're counting all these things. You count the number of people that attend the meetings. You count the number of leads that you generated. You count the number of contracts that were signed. You count the number of new solar permits that were issued. These are all easy things to do if you're working with a municipality. And then you report back to the town council, town board, you know, the trustees, whomever's running the government, and that's kind of like a self-perpetuating, you know, because you've shown now that there is interest by the constituents, you are making progress towards the goal, and the community's happier because they're saving money and they're investing in renewable technologies, and the whole, it's just it's an overwhelming feel-good experience for everyone. So I think I'll stop there, Sierra.
Yeah, no, great. So you guys have questions for each other, and then we'll open it up to the rest of the group. John and Mark.
Well, I want to ask about the PACE speaker. I'm sorry, I forgot the gentleman's name.
Mark Scully.
Mark, I'd like to know how, if you could talk about the difficulty or not difficulty, you know, getting the data from your utility or, you know, regarding energy. I think getting gas is, consumption is not as hard, but getting electricity, were you actually able to get that? And then the second question on top, you know, related to that is going to be interconnect turns out to be one of the biggest challenges, at least here in the zone that I live in. So is the utility that you work in Connecticut willing to share, you know, what substations are loaded and which ones are not? Because sometimes, like, if you're trying to do a community solar project, I mean, you know, I do residential, but I also work on utility scale projects as well. And part of the challenge is knowing in a very transparent fashion where is the opportunity to implement large projects. So could you comment on that?
Yes, those great questions. I think to look at the details to see if we're much better off. But I know several years ago, some of the clean energy advocates went through a process of, I think it required legislation to force the electric utilities to provide us a degree of data about energy usage in the town. So I think kicking and screaming, they've complied with it. And so what we get is, and we now have a sort of a blanket file for them for every single town state. And what it is, it's the aggregate separate for commercial and residential. We've got the electricity usage and natural gas. We would love to broken down into more detail, you know, the commercial and industrial or the certain meter types, but at least we get the total electricity and the total gas separate for residential commercial for every town in the state. We've got two investor-owned utilities and a handful of municipal utilities. And your second was I'm drawing a blank. What was your second question again?
Where can you add, is the utility transparent about where you can add utility scale solar or battery storage? You know, like is that data, readily available?
The what the utility provides us are hosting capacity maps. So it's on their website. I can share a link if anybody wants to compare. But what it shows is sort of color coded each of the circuits, each of the substations and circuits are color coded based on the amount of capacity remaining. So it's not everything we'd like it to be. It's not a GIS file that we could actually do some analysis with, but it is, I think, a first source to check and say, gee, this, if we wanted to put it here, how does the circuit, you know, look? And then we'd want to have detailed discussions. So I don't know if that's better or worse than what other states have, but it seems like a pretty good first thing to look at.
Yeah, it seems to me that we would all benefit by collaborating and making the argument for some sort of standardization in data. I mean, I think what you're talking about are, be nice to have like shape files, you know, the GIS shape files, so that you know where the boundaries are.
Right. Right.
And that just, there's no, you know, I worked before I got into this business. I worked at IBM, and I really appreciate the benefit of, you know, architectural standards from the 20 years of that experience. But you really need to, everybody needs to talk the same language. And now that environmental groups and consultants like us are interacting with they're not used to, you know, interacting with the public or interacting with public-private, you know, non-energy professionals, I guess you'd say, like us. So we need to either learn their language or they need to learn how to communicate with us.
I agree. And it seems every new request in terms of data or access information is it requires multiple steps and often requires these freedom of information or even legislation. So it's just unfortunate.
John, do you have any comments?
In terms of the specific difficulty of getting the data, I think I really can't be of much value there. I did want to comment. I wanted to compliment Mark on his talk, and I wanted one of the things he was talking about in his action plan was one of the things that it made me realize is that we, in our work in the communities, we often have kind of a parallel kind of a thing, but the action plan that we have is actually to get a diverse groups from the community together sitting at a table, and we give them a challenge. It's usually like making alternative kinds of changes they can make. And it's basically a land use kind of a challenge where they actually have to go in and talk through changes and how they would organize them in a neighborhood. And then what we have discovered is that process of getting people who all care about, like in this case, green energy, who all care about energy but come from very different directions, city agency, the homeowner, the commercial venture, whatever, getting them making collective decisions together, what it really does is they enter conversations they've never had before, and they're much better able to step out from their particular lens of seeing the world to appreciate a broader community lens. And so we find that much of the value we do is really geared toward people in the community becoming more open in the way they communicate together, and specifically the way they communicate making decisions for their community And just like Mark, we give them baseline information going in, and they identify benchmarks and that kind of thing. And we actually have grade sheets where they'll generate a scheme, and then they evaluate it using that grade sheet. Having made decisions for one reason, then the grade sheet tells them economically the implications of the decisions they thought would be good decisions to make, allowing them to design again. And so the whole baseline benchmarking and some way of quantitatively analyzing their proposed solutions have been the really good learning vehicle we've used in the communities.
John, when you do one of the charrettes, who's typically attending? Is it mostly town employees, or is it also stakeholders and volunteers from the town?
In our meetings?
Yeah, in your charrettes?
Yeah, in our charrettes, we specifically try to get all full diversity into participation. And so that when we sit down and people are sitting at a table working together as teams, their administrators, like from the energy department, maybe from the water department, because as they make an energy decision, it affects water decisions or food or whatever. And so we try to get the diversity of the community, both in terms of what their interests are, as well as what their roles in the community are. One of the things we often do at the very beginning, like if we do an exercise geared toward local food, at the very beginning we might say, okay, you've got 10 points. Allocate those 10 points based upon whether you're most concerned about food and having local food that's grown, whether you're more interested in community interaction one with another, or whether you're more concerned with economics and keeping dollars in the community. Based upon how they allocate those 10 points, they've begun to organize themselves, and then we form the tables trying to keep the full diversity of roles in the community, but to where one table is really looking more through an economic lens. The table next to them may be looking more through jobs and community dynamics lens. Another community may be looking more through how much local food can you grow. So depending on whether it's energy, water, or food, then we try to structure it with the diversity of the community, but also how to figure in into the gaming some way of having one group of people coming through somewhat of a different emphasis lens from the other groups. And typically, in these kind of sessions, we might have 60 or 70 people. We might wind up with 15 groups of 7 people each. Or, you know, we try to have teams, small enough teams, not over about 7 people, so everyone gets involved. And we just love to not say much, but just float around listening to the conversations in the group, because we found that if we can get a diverse group sitting at the table, there's a tremendous amount of vernacular knowledge, of knowledge of what it really takes for that community to operate, as well as then having a technical knowledge of someone from the utility company that understands that, or from the electrical department with the city that understands electrical versus food versus these other issues.
I'd like to open this up to other comments, so I will unmute everybody. Please keep your phones muted, and feel free to ask questions of the group here. Go ahead, Lynn, until we have somebody else dive in. Just dive in if you want to make a comment.
Yeah, hi, this is Jeff Hinsky. There's two comments, or maybe a comment and a question. One is, I guess Sherry, you're in Long Island, you said? PSIG Long Island.
It's actually Lynn.
Oh, excuse
Long
me.
Island.
Yeah, yeah.
That's my fault. I said Sherry. Yeah.
PSIG Long Island publishes a really crude hosting capacity map, but only at the substation level, and it's just yellow, green, red. So it's pretty crude relative to what a lot of other utilities are doing around the country now, or some utilities are doing anyway, but I'm not sure if you're aware of it, but you can find it just by, it's on the PSIG website in the interconnection area, I know. So, but again, it's just sort of a substation by substation capacity, yellow, green, red. But the comment or the question I had more, and maybe it's just, you know, as a developer, and a lot of our offtake clients are in municipalities and school districts and things like that, we are running into more and more local opposition, and they're very much, you know, the cities and or the schools, municipalities want to move forward with these kind of projects. And there are some type of special interest that tries to block it, or, you know, very much the NIMBY kind of approach that, well, you know, don't do it in our neighborhood or in our, you know, district, do it on the other side of town kind of thing. And has anyone got any insight how to kind of look at that or work with these people to get, you know, broader buy-in so, you know, the greater good can happen versus just protecting our particular, you know neighborhood?
Before that question's answered, I have two things. Please make sure your phones are muted because I am getting quite a bit of background noise here. And the other thing is I see a 312 number. Can you identify yourself, whoever that is? That just joined.
This is Rick Reepstein.
At 312? No, you're 339, Rick.
Oh, sorry.
312-286-03811. Anybody? Okay. All right. Well, we'll call it later. All right. Let's find out who it is. Yeah, that's all good. Okay, go ahead, Lynn. I'm sorry.
That's a really good question. And, in fact, I take it you live on Long Island?
No, I don't, actually, but we do a lot of work. We're up in Connecticut is where our main office is, so we do a lot of work
okay.
in the Northeast. Unfortunately, not a lot on Long Island because of the difficulties that you kind of have alluded to there. But
well, yeah, I think I'm in a unique perspective on this because of where I am. I'm in Southampton, and if you have any knowledge of the offshore wind farm that LIPA contracted as a result of a competitive bid a number of years ago, and then all the brouhaha from the people where the cable was going to land, as well as a certain industry, the fishermen were really unhappy. There's some clear lessons learned there. And that was in a neighboring town. That was all in East Hampton, and I live in Southampton, and I work with the Southampton town. But I attended every single meeting in order to learn. I think there's probably many ways to skin that cat, but in my opinion, based on my experience, I think you have to have trusted relationships with the planning, whatever function in the municipal government oversees land management and the building code. That's a critical element. I mean, there has to be building code, you know, in the jurisdictions where you want to do projects. Right now what's happening are a lot of natural gas fuel cells are trying to do business out here. And it's not going to happen. Not only do we not have building code to support that, but, in this day and age, there's understanding what the town board, in our case, our town board has a 100% renewable goal for electricity. So the idea of putting in a fuel cell, you know, in 2021 is not going to go over very well when there are other options. But the key to success is relationships. They have to be trusted. meaning, and you can get there as an outsider. You just have to, unfortunately, you have to invest the time. It's good to have some local stakeholders, you know, develop relationships with influential organizations that are doing business, you know, who have, like I said, trusted relationships with the municipalities, the decision makers, is critical because, you know, the people who vote at the end of the day, you know, as we just saw last week, you know, that's where the power is. And elected officials are going to listen if there's a strong point of view that's being represented by a credible source and it's being done in a professional way. That's really hard to overcome. I happen to also be the person who brought the community choice aggregation to Long Island. And I don't know if you've been following that at all, but it's been an uphill battle for a couple of years. But we were able to, I mean, on the flip side, we were able to get the law changed, and our state-owned, vertically integrated, self-regulating monopoly did create a CCA tariff last May, and they did that as a result of a marketing campaign that we organized. We involved the press. We involved elected officials. We involved the planning departments. We talked to multiple municipalities. We ran a outreach campaign, and we did it all during COVID, which is amazing. So, meaning we couldn't do any face-to-face meetings. We did absolutely no mailers. Everything was done through social media. We had a petition. But, you know, these are all, you know, it's almost like you need a PR person or organization to work with you to open up the market, you know, so that you can be successful. And the truth is, we want companies like yours. Like, I, personally, I don't sell anything. I'm a consultant. I sell ideas. You know, I'm paid to educate the public and help with the strategy for the town. But we want a market so that companies like yours will come here and do projects. I mean, that's the goal. And unfortunately, you know, there are some of these obstacles, but I think there are organizations like mine and others that exist here on Long Island that will, you know, if the political will is there, working together with companies like you, like-minded, you know, we can make that change happen. And I think I'll leave it there.
Anybody else who has not yet had a chance to talk, and this won't be the last conversation we had, so don't worry if you don't have time to cover everything because it's obviously a very comprehensive topic. Anybody else who hasn't had a chance to speak wants to say anything?
Yeah, this is Robert Perry. I'm in California, and I've been very much involved in local energy planning for the last 5-6 years, and you know, thought a lot about, you know, how do you get the public active on renewable energy? And I think, you know, this is just basically a comment. There needs to be, you know, a storyline, and you know, that applies universally to all towns. And I think when you talk about renewable energy, there's two subtexts. There's the environmental subtext about the need to reduce emissions and decarbonize the sector, and then there's the economic and social story, which is about energy resilience. Somebody needs to mute. Yeah. Hi.
Okay. Want to speak, one second, Robert. If anybody wants to talk, do a 4 and a star on your phone, and I can see that, and then I can call on you. So go ahead, Robert.
Anyway, there's some threads that are common to my experience. One was when Lynn said that she liked to work with municipalities because they're trusted. Absolutely, I would say the next trusted. Most trusted institution is educational. And so that kind of ties into John's work with Ball State. You know, there's a lot of work out here in California through our universities and colleges. And but back to the energy resilience, and all this ties to climate change because climate change is becoming the most disruptive element when it to local energy. And one thing that I find is critical to communicate is that energy resilience is inherently local. You cannot have resilient energy if you're relying on it being transported over long distances. So there's a certain percentage of energy that must be generated within the community in order for it to be able to continue to function during wildfires, in the case of California, earthquakes, or in the case of the East Coast, you know, storms, hurricanes, you know, all the seasonal type of events that happen. And so I'm working with a group, and what we're trying to do in California is we're submitting a proposal to set up a state program that would basically require communities to integrate energy planning into the general planning process. And it would set up a program and funding to empower the communities to determine how best to develop their local energy resources as part of a plan. And the program that John is doing with the Charettes, the PACE program that Mark's doing, kind of fall within an emerging area called concierge services. So, you know, if communities would be given the mandate and the funding and the support to develop their planning, but would need organizations like Lynn's and Mark's and John's to come in and help them. And this would all be part of a program. So this is kind of where, you know, this is still very much on the policy level. We introduced the legislation early last year, and then COVID just blew up the legislative calendar, and we're trying to reboot it next year. But I think this is, you know, there has to be an acknowledgement at a high level that this kind of community planning and organization is essential, you know, for economic and social reasons. And communities need to be given the power to determine their energy future. And that rubs up against the utilities who, of course, you know, are used to controlling everything. And Lynn, you know, you talked about resistance from utilities. That is hardly unique. That's probably the most universal thing out there, is that all the utilities are really not very open, and we're really kind of dragging and kicking and screaming. So anyway, that's my comment.
All right. Anybody else who has not yet been heard? No. Okay. Go ahead, panelists. We have a few minutes left. All right. Oops, I guess you can't talk because you're muted. Don't forget to unmute your lines. 4-star. Do you want to say something?
Okay, thanks. Yeah, this is Mark. Just one further thought to the question about how do you get these projects implemented and overcoming local resistance and you know, NIMBY. And I think you know, Lynn's answer was, you know, I think covered all the bases. It was great. I mean, it's a strategic approach you have to take. You know, if you're talking about a new school or a larger project, you've got to be involved early on in the planning. If you come in late, it's hopeless. As Lynn said, those relationships have to be there. You know, and that just affirms, I think, what we all are talking about here is that that's why we can do these things at the local level, because we know each other. You know, we vote for each other. We know our leaders. They know us. And then, you know, the only final point, I think, which is a bit of good news, a lot of these projects, you know, when we're talking about them, we don't
typically lead with climate change. We lead with economics. Every project we've done in my town has also saved the town money, or we've been able to bring in grants. So, you know, whether people, even believers, or somewhat on the fence about the climate issues, everybody wants to save money. So just my two cents.
Yes, this is John, and I'm also, I guess, responding to Jeff's comments originally about how to diffuse issues. Also, Lynn's comments about trusted relationships. I learned a number of years ago, actually work in South Africa, but it's a universal kind of a notion, is that the resistance usually happens once decisions have made who will ultimately be the winners and losers. And so generally the trust is built by having conversations before the decisions have actually been made, like design decisions or whatever, and trying to have the conversations that start back at the level that everyone agrees to, like goals for the community or something, and how to bring people along and get that conversation to be fleshed out to the point of the kinds of things that ought to be affecting decisions, and then be able to come forward with a strategy or a project that meets those community agreed upon kinds of directions, and then you tend to have less resistance because everyone's bought in before the project decides who's going to be the winners and the losers, and whether people still feel that they're kind of coming out on the short end, they at least feel they've had a voice in the decision rather than having something thrust upon them and having to cope with it after the fact.
We're just about out of time. It's one more comment here, especially if anybody hasn't had a chance to speak yet, and do a 4-star to unmute your level. All right.
I just want to, if I could just weigh in on that last comment. This is Lynn speaking. I completely agree. Talking in advance is absolutely critical. But part of the problem is, like one of people who ask questions is a developer from out of state. It's important to have a lot of public hearings, but you really have to have a plan. You know, there has to be, somebody has to take the reins and say, okay, this is what we're going to do. You know, we're going to, and in my opinion, what's been very successful, unfortunately, living in New York under Governor Cuomo's leadership and his, you know, his staff, we have goals that have been set out for us. All we need to do locally is just communicate those goals and show how we're aligning with them, and then we're creating and executing programs to create tangible results. Because, you know, fundamentally there's a chicken and egg problem. I mean, where do you start? You know, like the gentleman who asked me the question about how do I do more business on Long Island. Well, you know, a company from out of state wants to do business anywhere it can. So how do they determine, you know, well, Southampton is going to be the place, and, you know, the sales cycle and the labor involved in investing time to develop relationships, oh, my God, what's that going to cost? You know, it's just that I don't see that as being a means to an end. So I guess what I want to say is we try to focus on creating tangible results. Yeah, there is a happy medium, and, yeah, you do need to do a lot of public outreach, and you need to have public hearings and make sure people feel that they're involved. But you got to move the needle. The most important thing is to do projects, show progress, get started somewhere, you know, and I guess that'll be my final word. Just don't wait, because we don't have time. you know, with climate change and what have you. Sense of urgency.
All right. So this is actually the beginning of a longer conversation that I've been thinking about for a number of years. well, I've actually done it a number of years ago, but it's gotten a lot more sophisticated now than it was way back when I started out with all of this. So let me think about it. I'll be in touch with you guys as far as putting together some kind of a program that we can get out on webinars and invite cities in a more, organized way so that we can educate them on some of the processes that you guys have talked about. And I've got a lot of ideas on that. I just need time to think about it and how to implement them. Great job, guys. Good panel. Hope you got something out of it, and hope to see you all next time. Next webinar or conference call is going to be quite different. Vu Nguyen is going to be talking about applications, pros and cons of virtual PPAs. So different topic, but also important, more on the technical end of it, but that's all part of this process as well. Thanks again to everybody for coming, and thanks to our presenters for an outstanding presentation.
Thank you, Sierra.